NHS to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, regular host for the show, and also the founder of Yes to Life, the UK charity that's been advocating for integrative medicine, the inclusion of a broad range of lifestyle and complementary medicine into cancer care, for more than 15 years. The Yes to Life show is all about integrative medicine for cancer, or integrative oncology as it's correctly called, and my guest today is going to be talking about the development of the understanding of cancer and how this has impacted on our success at both treating and preventing cancer. Sam Apple is author of a brilliant new book, Ravenous. I'm speaking to Sam over the internet in New York. Sam, I'm absolutely delighted you agreed to come on the show to talk about your new book, Ravenous.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So it's got the subtitle of Otto Warburg, The Nazis and the Search for the Cancer Diet Connection. So there's an absolute mass of stuff in here. I found it an absolutely compulsive page turner. It tells the story of German research scientist Otto Warburg and his groundbreaking work on cancer. And whereas there's certainly some meaty science in the book, it's all very accessible to non-scientists like myself, and it reads more like a great story. Do you see Ravenous simply as a history of science, or did you write it with an intention to contribute to current scientific debate on cancer in some way?
I would say that I wrote it to contribute to the current debate. I started the project with an interest in the science and thinking about how I would tell a story about the science. And then I encountered Otto Warburg and saw that his life would be a natural way for me to tell the story and that he would be my main character. But what I ultimately wanted to do was to write about cancer metabolism, how cancer cells use energy, and what that might reveal to us about, you know, what we can do with respect to our diets to prevent more cancer.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about Warburg himself. One of the aspects that leaps out at you unavoidably throughout the book is his character, his ability to dismiss interventions by the most feared Nazis as though he was kind of swatting flies, whilst living right in the heart of Nazi Germany as fairly clearly a homosexual, a part Jew. I mean, it kind of makes for stunning reading, hard to believe even. This seemed to stem from his hugely arrogant and inflated views about his own abilities and value, which in many ways weren't entirely inaccurate. But this did mean, of course, that he was pretty obnoxious as well to deal with, from what I hear and what your book says. I think nowadays he'd probably be ascribed having some kind of clinical condition. But how much do you think his character contributed to his ability to break new ground in science?
It's a good question. I think it made a very big difference. I think that most people with his personality that think of themselves as brilliant and superior to other people are actually not, in fact, brilliant and superior to other people, and often quite foolish. But he was the rare sort of megalomaniac that actually could sort of support his views of himself. He really was brilliant. He really, you know, was a genius by almost all accounts. Later in life, he wasn't as, scientifically impressive, but certainly in the first decades of his career, he was, you know, an astonishingly impressive scientist. And I do think his self-belief was a great part of his success, that, when he set out to tackle a scientific problem, he took as his assumption that he was going to solve it. And if he didn't have the proper scientific tools, he would invent them or re-engineer existing tools. And, you know, it takes a certain amount of self-belief to tackle questions that no scientist in history has been able to solve. So, he was a difficult person to be around. And, I don't think that those traits are necessarily admirable in most cases, but it did lead him to astonishing scientific breakthroughs.
Strange, isn't it? So, he's best known, of course, for the Warburg effect, a discovery that earned him a Nobel Prize. I wonder if you'd explain in simple terms what the Warburg effect is and why it was such an important step in science.
Sure. So Otto Warburg had already, in 1923, when he starts to really focus on cancer, by that point, he had already been interested in how cells take up oxygen and use the energy to grow. And when he started to look at the metabolism of cancer cells, he expected to find that cancer cells would take up more oxygen than other cells because they're growing rapidly and you need oxygen to burn with your nutrients for energy. And so he sets off to do these experiments and is, you know, quite surprised to see that the cancer cells that he's studying are actually not taking up more oxygen. They're instead taking up a lot of glucose, a lot of the, you know, the sugar in our in animals' blood, and breaking it down very rapidly by the process of fermentation. It's the same process that, you know, microorganisms, yeast and bacteria use that give us all the foods that we're familiar with, beer, bread and wine and yogurt and cheese. So Warburg knew that a human cell could do this. It had been discovered not that long before, but it was always thought that a cell would only do this in desperation if it didn't have enough oxygen or wasn't able to use oxygen properly. And the cancer cells seemed to have oxygen and that they were still turning to fermentation. They were still doing this process, which I call in my book Ravenous. It's like a backup generator. That's how it was thought of. And so, you know, this question is, why are cancer cells doing this? And, you know, does it reveal anything new about how to treat cancer, prevent cancer? And, you know, that debate really continues to this day. Mm-hmm. But Warburg himself became convinced that Warburg effect, which is turning to fermentation, even in the presence of oxygen, had to exist only because there must be some sort of defect in the cell. It had to be that a cell wasn't able to use the oxygen properly, and so was revving up fermentation. And scientists today don't necessarily agree with that interpretation, but they do agree that he discovered something very fundamental, that, you know, 70% or more of cancers will overconsume glucose, and that this is fundamental to what cancer is. In fact, one of the most popular or one of the most important diagnostic tests now is the PET scan, in which, you know, you simply give somebody radioactive glucose and see where in the body that's being taken up more. And that's how you identify the cancer.
Yeah. And I'm interested in this concept that maybe because fermentation is a kind of a precondition that existed before complex animals came into existence, that somehow we're reverting to a previous form of generating energy because of an absence, if you like, of the fundamentals that are needed, that are required for the complex generation of energy that we normally rely on. Is that something that you've come across or you would ascribe to?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is actually how Warburg sort of envisioned it, that you know, not able to use oxygen properly, a cell was reverting to this sort of more ancient form of metabolism, and that cancer arose in Warburg's view because fermentation was not able to sort of generate sufficient energy for the cell to, you know, carry out its normal function. So, you know, that idea is still around. And I do think that conceptually, thinking of cancer as a reversion to a different kind of metabolism does make sense. But, you know, the challenge to Warburg's interpretation really is that, you know, it's not clear to scientists today that cancer cells are turning to fermentation necessarily because they have to,
right?
Because there's a defect, because many cancers will take up more glucose, but still continue to use respiration, still take up oxygen and burn nutrients in the mitochondria. So, you know, the interpretations are tricky, but, you know, it is striking. One of the first things Warburg said is that, you know, cancer cells seem to resemble yeast, and, you know, the parallels are quite striking. There was one prominent cancer scientist, Craig Thompson, who's now the president and CEO of Memorial Sloan Kettering, one of the world's leading cancer institutes. And when he talks about, and he's also one of the individuals who made some of the key discoveries about cancer metabolism in the last decades, when he explains what cancer is, he puts, you know, when he's speaking to a lay audience, he puts up a piece of bread and shows mold spreading across the bread. And he says, you know, that's basically exactly what cancer does. It, you know, starts in one spot, takes up as many nutrients as it can. When cancer runs out of nutrients or can't, you know, continue to multiply, you actually see the mold spreading over the bread. He said that's like metastasis. So it is a reversion to, you know, something very fundamental that our cells can do, and that you know, has existed throughout the, you know, the evolution of eukaryotic life. But you know, there's a lot of nuance in these discussions.
Okay, so you know, you've kind of hung the story around Warburg, but it's as much as anything a story of the Nazis and the development of science in Germany, which is absolutely fascinating, I've found. I've long sort of vaguely heard of the fact that the reason that integrative medicine, integrative cancer care in particular, is so much more advanced in Germany than elsewhere in Europe is because of the Nazis. And I was like, oh, right, okay. You know, strange, but true, maybe. But your book goes into far more depth into what the Nazis were actually up to, what their thinking was. And yeah, so this background of, with the thinking in Germany around the first half of the 20th century is a huge part of the book, and I'm very, really interested in it. One of the things that continually shocked and surprised me as I read Ravenous was the public attitude towards cancer in Germany. Given that relative to today's statistics, the incidence of cancer at the time was pretty insignificant, the public's response seemed to be more akin to the recent pandemic, while we seem to be almost at home with the idea of half of us getting cancer within our lifetime. So I wanted to read a couple of sentences from the book that illustrate this. To confront this enemy, Dresden's Hygiene Museum created a travelling exhibit called The Fight Against Cancer. More than 500,000 people visited it, so many that police would sometimes have to cordon off the huge crowds that would form outside its temporary exhibit halls. The acclaimed German doctor Ferdinand Sauerbruch reported that due to the exhibit, his clinic was being overrun by panic-stricken patients showing up with nothing but warts. He called for the exhibit to be shut down. So, what factors do you think contributed to this German dread of cancer? Also, what do you think underpins the current complacency, I would say, in comparison, with the situation we have now?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that. In my mind, this is one of the key points in the book, and in some ways, you know, perhaps the most provocative or controversial argument that I make. But my starting point for this discussion is really that cancer was once quite rare disease. Certainly, it's always existed and exists in many species. But prior to the 19th century, and particularly the second half of the 19th century, cancer seemed to be much less common. And then beginning in the middle of the 19th century, it grows more and more common. And, you know, it's a hard argument to make because there's always the counterpoint. Well, we have new ways to diagnose cancer, or people start to live, you know, to older ages, and that's why there's more cancer. So I have to, you know, I won't go into all that here, but I try to take on those arguments in the book. But my starting point is that cancer was growing more common. And I think that explains why we had this reaction in the late 19th and early 20th century in Germany in particular, though in other countries as well. They were panicked because they hadn't seen cancer like this before. And they had made, you know, in Germany in particular, had made great progress against infectious diseases, had, you know, successfully identified which microorganisms caused infectious diseases, and had a lot of sanitation programs which led to prevention. But cancer was just getting worse and worse, you know, year by year, decade by decade, the numbers were going up. You know, it went from a rare disease to suddenly everybody knew somebody who had cancer. And you know, they were understandably panicked. And you know, I think that's why Warburg took on cancer, because he grew up in a generation of Germans that thought they could conquer any illness and could not conquer cancer. And Warburg, you know, wanted to make a great discovery. So cancer was the disease of the moment.
Well, but now we have a situation which is, you know, vastly worse in terms. I mean, I think you write in the book it was like 1 in 8 around that time, and now it's 1 in 2. I mean, that's astronomically worse. And yet it's something we seem to kind of live with now. It's strange. I mean, how's that come about, do you think?
Yeah, I thought about this a lot. In fact, I wanted to write an opinion piece that made the argument that, what we really need to do is return to the cancer panic. I don't want people to be panicked, but we need a sense of urgency. We need a sense that, to think of cancer in the way that we think of COVID-19, because, frankly, it's, each year it kills people in numbers, beyond COVID-19,
Exactly.
at least in the United States. So how we became complacent, I think, because, it happened so gradually, and because, we have not had success at any point. But I do think that conceptually it was not helpful in a way when we identified cancer-causing genes in 1970s. When I say not helpful, it's very helpful in terms of the science. What I say is, I think it led to a feeling that cancer was random and inevitable. You get an unlucky mutation and you cause cancer. I think that's what a lot of people think, and some scientists still think. But the reality has been that all along, it's been, I think, widely agreed upon that at least 40 or 50%, I think, higher cancers are actually preventable. So we've sort of, in thinking about bad luck and mutations, we've sort of forgotten that the evidence has always been that most cancers are caused by our lifestyle. But if we've resigned ourselves to, accepting that, it's in part because we haven't really figured out exactly what it is about our lifestyles. Smoking was the great success, but we have not solved the fundamental question. And the argument in my book is that we've possibly missed the single biggest factor, which would be, poor metabolic health and insulin resistance.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, this is one of the things that your book really opened my eyes to, is lots of concepts that I would have thought were modern, were clearly they were common 100 years ago in Germany. These attitudes towards the preventability of cancer, and how many of them were generated by lifestyle. At that time, they were seeing it as a disease of civilization, that developing nations were increasingly living in ways that created cancer. So you only got to look at a current world map of cancer incidence to see the truth behind this. But nonetheless, as you say, it was very recently there were kind of headline making pronouncements from John Hopkins that it was, largely just bad luck. I'm glad to say that met with quite a lot of protest, but nonetheless, it seems a ridiculous thing to say in the face of, say, just looking at a world map of who gets cancer most. It follows the money in the main. So, as I say, there are an awful lot of concepts that the Germans were looking at as being under investigation as agents of cancer back 100 years ago. Do you want to tell us some of those and comment on how this thread of investigation became sort of lost on the way and it's re-emerged now?
Yeah, so the Germans in the late 19th century were really, leading the world in science, infectious diseases, perhaps first and foremost, but really, in many different fields, you had to know German even to sort of be in the scientific conversation. The journals are in German. And so cancer is one more disease where the Germans were at the forefront. And one area in which they led the way most of all was perhaps in identifying carcinogens in the environment. They were trying to solve this problem, which we've talked about, is why cancer is becoming more common with a modern lifestyle. And there were many possibilities. It could have been something about the food itself. It could have been a chemical added to the food. It could have been something in the air. It could have been plastic products and so on. And this was a great mystery. And the Germans were really the first to identify specific chemicals that caused cancer that were being used in industry. And, amazingly, I didn't know this until I started to research my book, but the Germans were way ahead on identifying smoking and cancer. This happened under the Nazis, actually, 20 years before the Americans and the Europeans had put the pieces together. German scientists had already made a pretty strong case against smoking. So the Germans were way ahead on all these issues, and it's troubling in some ways to think that the Nazis could have made progress on anything. But you have to remember, they inherited a the world's best scientific establishment, and they put a lot of money and resources into cancer research. So it makes sense that they would have made progress. But nevertheless, I'd like to add that my argument is ultimately that I think, although this research was valuable, my argument is that we've probably been misled a little bit by the focus on chemicals in the environment. Not to say that these don't cause some cancers, but that it's maybe distracted us from the more fundamental role of diets that are, high in sugars and refined grains that are causing insulin to rise in our blood, this hormone which acts like a growth factor.
So it's interesting this connection. Well, so what we have is we have the key figures in the Nazi movement. Many of them seem to be completely obsessed with this whole area. So they're not only obsessed with the carcinogens in the environment, but also, as you've been just speaking about, with to do with diet and what a health promoting, cancer preventive diet could look like. And that again seems like very modern thinking in many ways. There are plenty of people thinking and trying to live that way right now. I'm just interested. It seems to me that it's a very unfortunate conjugation, this mixture of Nazism, which is one of the worst things to happen in the 20th century, maybe the worst, and all this very wholesome stuff about trying to address cancer and chronic disease. And that maybe some of the setbacks that have happened within the science that they were promoting is because of the bad rap that the Nazis had in total. Do you make a connection there?
Well, I do think that there is a lot of science about metabolism, including Warburg science, that was lost after World War II. And I think part of the reason it was lost is, part of it was just the chaos of war, but also that, no one really wanting to take the ideas of German scientists seriously in the post-war period and not wanting to return to some of these German scientists. So I do think that played a role. But just to expand on some of these ideas that we've been talking about, the Nazis, their whole project was really about hygiene. This is the Stanford historian Robert Proctor, who's written a book called The Nazi War on Cancer, says the entire Nazi project is really one big hygiene experiment. So, in their sort of twisted worldview, any chemical that could harm the pure Aryan body was, had to be eliminated from society. And in a way, the Jews were only one more impurity on their list of impurities. And so, I think it's important to point out that even when the Nazis were progressive, that it all, was channeled through this, kind of grotesque ideology. But they did make progress, and they did, even the term whole foods, which is now, synonymous with healthy eating, really started with, somebody who had been part of, a Nazi who sort of reestablished himself after the war. So it's true that the Nazis were ahead on many of these issues, but it doesn't mean that that stood in contradiction to their worldview.
Yeah, no, I can see that they very cleverly did wrap it all up in their twisted ideology, as you say, and it did all seem to line up and make one picture. But standing on its own, a lot of it was still good science and still very worthwhile investigation. But I just wonder whether the negativity attached to everything the Nazis had done, including, of course, their ideology, was the thing that really led to this falling away of their science in that way, and that it's taken another, 75 years or something for it to now be current again.
Yeah. No, I think that, I'll use Warburg as a prime example, that there were plenty of other examples. But, after the war, Warburg begins to sort of fade away. He continues to, write papers and to make his claim that cancer is a metabolic disease. And this had been, a really fundamental discovery. But no one's paying attention to it in the decades after the war. And by the time Warburg dies in 1970 or shortly thereafter, he's almost completely erased. And you have to ask yourself why this is happening. You know, maybe the single most important explanation is that science, you know, it can be like a pendulum, and it swung in another direction with the discovery of mutations and oncogenes. But at the same time, you know, Warburg's fundamental discovery that cancer cells are overeating glucose was never controversial. You know, why they're doing it is controversial, but that they're doing it was not controversial. And it's so fundamental that it's really extraordinary that it disappeared. And I think that it has to be, at least in part, that nobody wanted to deal with science that the Nazis have dealt with. And in fact, one of the scientists who rediscovered Warburg in the 90s was Chi Van Deng. And he was at Johns Hopkins and at the University of Pennsylvania when he had his first big paper published in 1997. So this is, you know, almost 50 years after the war, 50 years after the war. And somebody takes him aside and says, you know, you got to be careful. You're getting into some dangerous political stuff here, talking about Otto Warburg, really? Who, wow. You know, people suspected. So really throughout the second half of the 20th century, that continued, that suspicion of anything related to Germany continued to play a role.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's extremely unfortunate for the science around cancer, it would seem. Yeah. You know, there's so many things that I read in your book which sound so contemporary now, but it is, you know, it's taken more than 50 years to get back to it. Yeah. You quote Himmler here as having studied agriculture and worked in a fertilizer factory. He thought about diet a lot, and you quote him as saying, "The artificial is everywhere. Everywhere food is adulterated, filled with ingredients that supposedly make it last longer or look better or pass as enriched." So that is so contemporary. I mean, you know, it must have been not nearly as bad then as it is now, the state of our food. But there he is saying something that could be a quote from today.
Yeah, no, it's chilling. You know, I, you know, after Hitler, you know, Himmler is, you know, maybe the, you know, one of the greatest monsters in history. And it's just such a jarring thing to hear him, you know, be interested in organic farming and to make these statements, you know, about food that, you know, many of which I agree with. But, you know, it's there's no contradiction between, you know, being a monster and occasionally stumbling onto an idea that makes sense. And, you know, the Nazis were, before they sort of became, you know, got into the cult of Hitler, they were relatively rational, normal people, and by and large, and, you know, corrupted their thinking, but it doesn't mean that they got every question wrong about nutrition. But I did find it satisfying in a sense that they got the most important question wrong, which is that they missed the sugar story, which, you know, Hitler in particular was, you know, just a glutton for sugar and ate it constantly. And my conclusion in the book is that sugar is probably the single most harmful thing you can eat in the context of cancer, because it does so much to contribute to insulin resistance.
It's curious that, you know, Hitler, as you say, he was sort of paranoid about cancer, really, it sounds like. And yet, as you say, he was a sugarholic. But of course, he must have known about Warburg's work and everything. So that was a strange mixture, wasn't it?
Warburg, you know, concluded that cancer was being fueled by glucose in our blood, but he actually didn't himself trace it back to sucrose, the sweet white sugar that we eat. So, you know, it seems like the connection should be obvious, but it took a while for the pieces, you know, to come together. So Warburg himself actually thought that the way that diet was causing cancer was you would eat foods with different, you know, chemicals, or get chemicals in your body from the environment, and that these would poison the mitochondria, these power plants in our cells, and then the mitochondria were poisoned, then you had to turn to fermentation as this backup generator. And, you know, what I'm arguing at the end of the book is that it's actually, you know, the carbohydrates and sugar in particular that are causing this hormone insulin to rise, and that's sort of overfeeding and overstimulating the cells. So in both cases, it's the shift to fermentation, but it's a question of how you get there.
Well, the concept of starving cancer with low carb diets, again, we think of as rather contemporary, but it's really not at all, is it, as you've highlighted in your book. I mean, the earliest mention, I think, in your book is this 1810 Observations on the Cure of Cancer by Thomas Denman, a Scottish surgeon. He wrote that it was thought, if not proved, that those who became corpulent or fat are more susceptible to cancer, and also that cancer was a more rapid and intractable disease among the overweight. Well, you know, we just had Cancer Research UK campaign on obesity over here as though it was a kind of new thing. But this is more than 200 years ago he's reached this conclusion. So, you know, and certainly not a new idea.
No, I mean, I think that's, so important, and it amazed me when I found that it was, on the radar of doctors as far back as, the early 19th century. The question, I think about what my book might be able to contribute, and I'm not a scientist. I'm mostly just doing research and talking to scientists and trying to communicate their views. But one thing that I do think a journalist can do is, what I call dot connecting two different stories. So there really have been, since the 1990s, two different stories going on. One has been just more and more research on the level of the population showing that excess weight is related to cancer. And then apart from that, a whole different group of scientists have been unraveling what's going on inside the cancer cell, returning to some of Warburg science. And both teams of scientists they aren't necessarily talking to each other, but they're coming to the same conclusion, which is that that cancer seems to be that the key pathways seem to be responsive to the hormone insulin. And insulin could explain the obesity, and it could explain the cancer. So, I've tried to connect these stories to, as I say in the introduction to my book, Warburg discovered that cancer is a problem of overeating glucose, and the epidemiologists have discovered that our eating habits have led to obesity and cancer. And these two phenomena have to be connected in some way. And I do think that this hormone insulin probably is the best explanation for the connection. And you mentioned before about how the key science had been lost in Germany before the war. One thing that got lost, which I don't really discuss this much in my book, but the science writer Gary Taubes writes about this a lot, is that the understanding of obesity as being caused by hormones had really been established in Germany before the war, and that got completely lost and is lost to this day. We still have this model to this day that obesity is caused by, too many calories or not exercise enough. And the relationship seems to be hormonal, that obesity is caused by refined grains and sugars raising the hormone insulin. And so in both cases, the thing that was missed really is the hormonal influence.
Interesting. So, one of the things we could talk about now is to do with the scientific method in general. I mean, the single most striking factor about the research into cancer is that despite almost unlimited application of resources, so little progress has been made. If you look at the cause of cancer, bringing the incidence of cancer under control, well, we're nowhere near it. You know, the talk of success, but it's sort of damage limitation, if you like. So, and then to find out that so many of the ideas we think of as new or current are actually 1 or even 2 centuries old, it makes you wonder, well, what hope have we got of moving forward rather than round and round in circles? And if I ask myself what the factors underpinning this failure to advance could be, the aggressive adversarial kind of right, wrong, proven quackery scientific method is one of the first things that comes to my mind. And of course, Warburg himself was right in the thick of this. He was a terrible example of somebody who just attacked anybody who disagreed with him and that kind of thing. do you think this is part of the problem, or the problem, or, you know, what? How come we're making so little progress?
Well, I like to distinguish between progress and prevention, and progress and therapy.
Okay.
I think, you know, in the context of cancer therapy, I think that, you know, we're making little progress, you know, in part because the predominant paradigm, which is, you know, identifying specific mutated genes and trying to target them, has not really worked. You know, there have been a few success stories and a few remarkable drugs that have emerged, but cancer has proven to be much more complicated than, you know, than we realized in the 70s, that when they start to do genomic sequencing and looking at these cancers, you know, they're just full of mutations, and you can't, in most cases, can't successfully just target one. You know, it's vastly more complicated. And I think the scientific establishment is slowly coming around to that. So, you know, the more exciting stuff in recent years has actually been, you know, in the context of, you know, immune-based therapies. And I think there's more hope for that. And, you know, it's been, you know, I think all these researchers are well-intentioned and, you know, many of them brilliant. It's just been a maddeningly difficult problem to solve. And, you know, unfortunately, the financial incentives are set up in such a way that there's a big incentive to, you know, create drugs that make almost no difference, that, you know, at best keep people alive for a few extra months. And you know, it's incredibly unfortunate that the system works that way. But, you know, I'm more optimistic about prevention because, you know, the argument in my book is that we may have missed, you know, the single biggest factor in terms of metabolic health. And if I'm right about that, and of course, this isn't just my idea, but I'm, you know, quoting scientists, but, you know, if I'm right about that, then there's enormous room for improving our prevention campaigns by focusing on, you know, getting sugar out of the diet and, you know, reversing this problem of insulin resistance. But that itself is a massive challenge. You know, by in America, by one estimate, 88% of adults have some degree of insulin resistance, of too much of this hormone, which is now so strong linked to cancer. So that will be a battle as well, but we know how to solve, you know, that's a little more straightforward.
Yeah, what a massive figure, 88%. There is also a danger, though, isn't there, that the problems caused by that can actually then be genetically handed down to another generation who get off to a very bad start.
Yeah, it makes it all the more difficult. You know, I would say epigenetically, you know, what seems to be happening, and, you know, science is still a little inconclusive, I think, but when you have elevated insulin, when a mother has that during pregnancy, that the child is then born with a greater likelihood of having obesity and elevated insulin, which, you know, are the risk factors for cancer. So it, unfortunately, I think that's part of, you know, why we're in such bad shape now, is that we're already starting to see these next generation from the, you know, the obesity epidemic that really began in the last decades of the 20th century.
It's a difficult thing to tackle. But anyway, I think you're right. Is that, I mean, most of the money and effort has gone into treatment rather than prevention. You know, Cancer Research UK spends a trivial amount on prevention compared to the amount that gets put into treatment. So that's definitely where the effort needs to go, considering the incidence carries on rising inexorably. We've got to do something at the sharp end and actually stop it happening rather than trying to pick up the pieces. So I'm glad you're optimistic about that. Warburg, he held on tenaciously to his prime cause right up until his death, didn't he? Choosing to simply ignore any developing science that threatened to destabilise some of his thinking. That he, you know, he went from being this awesome scientist, unfortunately, to just kind of defending his patch, it sounds like. Since his death, we got the emergence of the reverse Warburg effect, which could be seen as making his entire legacy into a massive red herring. How do you see Warburg's contribution to the advancement of the understanding of cancer, given that?
Well, my feeling is that Warburg got the big picture right. He insisted that cancer, should be thought of as a metabolic disease. And even though, in the second half of his life, he got a lot of things wrong and overstated his case, that he never moved away from what he saw, which is that the shift from respiration to fermentation, this metabolic shift, was at the root of cancer, and that that is his legacy in my mind in the context of cancer research. And all these scientists who have rediscovered Warburg in the 1990s and in more recent years, they don't disagree with much of what he said in the post-war period, but they see that this basic fact about cancer he got right. And so many people missed it or said it wasn't important, and he was there shouting, "This is the whole story." And it's not necessarily the whole story, but it's very fundamental. And to appreciate why, and when these cancer scientists were studying oncogenes, they weren't thinking about how a cell takes up energy, how it eats, how it fuels itself. They were thinking of how a cell divides and divides and divides. And as they started to unravel these oncogenes, these cancer-causing genes, what they found is that their first role seems to be to actually control the way a cell eats. And that this might be the most fundamental thing, because if you try to divide and divide and divide and you don't have the nutrients, you don't become a cancer. The cell, it's a catastrophe for the cell, as one cancer scientist put it to me. So you have to have the ability to take up nutrients to become a cancer. And I think Warburg understood just at the most basic level. He looked, his father was a famous physicist, and he looked at everything through the lens of energy. And so I think he saw cancer through the most sort of clear lens, even though he made outrageous claims.
Well, I think really one of the most hopeful things about looking into prevention in terms and treatment actually in terms of energy in this way is that we get away from the direction that the science has been taking us in recent decades, which is trying to dive deeper and deeper and deeper into more and more detail and finding out that there's actually the complexity is way beyond anything we could possibly cope with. Whereas this is actually rather the opposite movement. It's pulling right back out and finding, well, what's the bottom line? What's the most common factor in cancer that we may be able to have some effect on? So, it does seem a million times more hopeful to me, to find some answers that are genuinely useful to a lot of people.
And even when Warburg was making obnoxious statements, he would say things that I think ring true today, which is that all these new discoveries that we're making, that we see press releases on and news articles about, they're interesting, but they're ultimately can be a distraction as well. That we want to continue to invest in basic science and make new discoveries, but we have to, maintain the ability to see, what's most fundamental. So he was saying that in the 60s and was skeptical of where, it was still the very early stages of the understanding of the genetics of cancer, but he was already very skeptical of it. And I think it really is, just fundamental to step back and ask, is it possible that something in our diet is causing cancer cells to take up nutrients in this way? Because you could imagine a case where a cancer cell gets a mutation, right? And that gives it the ability to overeat glucose, and that would explain, Warburg effect, and had nothing to do with diet. It could just be an unlucky mutation. So the question I'm really interested in is it possible that it's not just an unlucky mutation, but the way that we eat stimulates these cancer-causing pathways? And in the early 2000s, they started to do genomic analysis and to look the sequencing and to look at where the most common mutations were. And it turned out they were in this pathway that responds to insulin. And so, the model now is that, we have these microscopic tumors, and many of them might never be harmful at all. But when they're more receptive to insulin and you have elevated insulin in your blood, it's functioning like a growth factor, giving these microscopic cancers a chance to stay alive and to grow and to resist these cell suicide mechanisms. So the diet connection, you know, really has emerged more and more. A lot of this work came out of the laboratory of Lewis Cantley, who's the one of the most important cancer scientists in the United States, and I think will likely win a Nobel Prize one day because he's elucidated this pathway that responds to insulin. And, you know, what he says based on this science is that we're probably going to look back at this era one day and think about sugar and the way we thought about smoking, because he's seen that sugar raises insulin. Insulin activates this pathway that is so profoundly linked to cancer. He calls it insulin is the, you know, there are other ways to activate it, but nothing activates it in the way that insulin does. So I think it's pretty remarkable that all the science is coming together.
Mm. Okay, well, your book is clearly a provocative statement in this direction, which I hope is going to stir up some debate and some interest in the area. If you're right, if he's right, we look back on sugar as being the kind of bigger version of smoking, probably has more effect than smoking across the population. It could be the biggest single step we make in cancer prevention and cancer treatment.
Yeah. And what's, I'll just add to that. What's interesting is that, you know, some people, you know, don't necessarily agree with, you know, some of these, don't agree that these mechanisms that I'm talking about are perhaps as important as I'm suggesting, but you don't even have to accept the science that I'm talking about to see the sugar connection, because almost everybody agrees that sugar is driving obesity and that obesity is profoundly linked to our most deadly cancers,
right.
13 cancers by current count. So forget all the science and just say sugar to obesity, obesity to cancer, if that's what you prefer. But either way, it's at the root of the story.
Mm. Okay, so we're going to have to end it there. Thanks so much for coming on the show. I totally love reading your book. It's so great to actually talk to you about it and to hear your passion, obviously, for the subject. And you've obviously put an enormous amount of time and energy into bringing all this stuff together in a way that, a scientist wouldn't do. But it's your kind of historical and author perspective that's brought the whole thing together.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much for your interest and for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
If you're listening to this show, then you are interested in cancer. Whether that interest is personal or professional, I highly recommend you get yourself a copy of Ravenous. You won't be disappointed. It's a riveting read and a genuine eye-opener. I'd like to thank all of you who supported my 70th birthday fundraiser, a sponsored ride from Land's End to the easternmost tip of Kent, mostly off-road. I'm delighted to report that I arrived unscathed and have so far raised over £22,500 for Yester Life. My fundraising page is still open, so if you'd like to contribute, just go to yesterlife.org.uk, scroll down the homepage until you see Robin's Senior Struggle, and then follow the links. If you want to see some of the day-by-day action, then take a look at my public Facebook page. Lastly, to let you know that on Saturday, October the 23rd, Yes to Life is jointly hosting an online forum with Penny Bron UK entitled Bridging the Gap. It will be asking the question, how do we gain the acceptance by oncology professionals of safe integrative interventions? It features senior NHS oncologist Dr. Penny Kekeyoglu, who co-hosts the Cancer Talk podcast series with me, Dr. Catherine Zollman, Medical Director of Penny Bron UK, Dr. Nina Fuller-Chavelle, co-chair of the British Society for Integrative Oncology, and others. The event's 3.5 hours long, and you can book now at very modest prices. Just go to yesterlife.org.uk and click the button in the Bridging the Gap banner at the top of the homepage. Thanks for listening today. Do join me again for next week's Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.
Thank you.